Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, November 30th, 2020, and I'm the host of the show, Kara Santamaria. If you live in the States, I hope you had a really happy Thanksgiving. I hope you stayed safe and you stayed socially distant. If you don't live in the States, maybe you had some turkey in our honor. Probably not, and that's okay. I hope you guys are staying safe out there as well. I'm really excited about this week's episode. I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Roy Meals to talk to him about his new book. But before we dive into that, I do want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week by visiting patreon.com/talknerdy and pledging your support. This week's top patrons are Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Christopher Pitts, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, Charles Payet, Brian Holden, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Robert Christ, and Elise Christie. Thank you all so much. And if you want to support the show in a non-monetary way, you can rate or review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or any podcast program where you listen to the show. You can also visit the Talk Nerdy store at talknerdy.com or talknerdymerch.com. And you can pick up some cool swag for the holidays. Not only will you show your support of the show or of my dog Killer, but you'll also be giving back financially to the show with each purchase. All right, let's talk about this week's episode. So I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Roy A. Meals. He is a clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA, and he's written several different medical texts. In addition, he blogs at aboutbone.com. And you guessed it, that's the topic of his newest book. It's called Bones, Inside and Out. So yeah, guys, let's talk about bones with Dr. Roy A. Meals. Engineer your screen there. And then I'm going to record on my backup here. Test, test. Okay, that looks good. And then my third backup. And looks like we're rolling on all fronts. Well, Roy, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So I'm really excited to talk about your new book, Bones, Inside and Out. I am kind of obsessed with bones. And I don't know if it's a morbid curiosity. I don't know if it's because I find a lot of beauty in the skeleton. But I was really excited when your book came across my desk because I thought this is a topic I don't think we've dug into with any real depth here on Talk Nerdy. So let's start with kind of the most obvious and general question, which is, how did you first, you know, many moons ago, become interested in bones?
Well, I grew up enjoying being outside in the summertime, and I grew up in Kansas City. And so in the wintertime, I spent a lot of time in the woodworking woodshop in our basement. And so outside in the summertime, I wasn't a particularly good athlete, so I watched birds and collected snakes and pressed flowers and leaves and so forth. And then in the winter, in the workshop, I took things apart and put them back together. And so I guess that it wasn't any surprise that when I went to college, I majored in biology. And then in medical school, I decided I wanted to be an orthopedic surgeon, and then followed that with a hand surgery fellowship. So I think this has been in my blood, you know, pretty much my whole life. And then as I accomplished of all my goals for being a practitioner in hand surgery, I kind of looked around and wondered how I could spend my energies, and looked back in my computer files recently and see that I had an outline for the Bones book as far back as 8 years ago. And so it's kind of been in my head rattling around. And then the last 3 or 4 years, I've worked on it rather regularly bring it to fruition this fall.
So when we think about orthopedic surgery, you know, I do think ortho brings up this idea of bones, but you don't only work with bones, do you?
No, we're the musculoskeletal specialists, and we work from the base of the skull down to the tips of the toes. The neurosurgeons and the head and neck surgeons and the plastic surgeons, they take care of the skull and the face. And the thoracic surgeons have to get past the rib cage or the sternum to get into what they consider the interesting parts of the body. But from the spine, top to bottom, and then upper and lower limbs, is that that's really the domain of the orthopedic surgeons. The podiatrists help manage some foot and ankle issues.
And are you usually in your career helping people who have congenital problems, helping people who have been in kind of experienced trauma through, you know, accidents or car collisions? Is it sort of an all of the above, just anything that could go wrong, that's what you tackle?
Right. Congenital differences aren't that common, but that's certainly within our domain of care. As a hand surgeon, I've managed lots of children with webbed fingers or born with absent thumbs or crooked forearms. And pediatric orthopedic surgeons deal with the children that are born with short legs and abnormally shaped feet and all sorts of things, curvature of the spine, issues like that. But that for most orthopedic surgeons, that would constitute a small fraction of their practice. And the main type of disease that orthopedic surgeons take care of is trauma. People falling down and breaking their wrist or tearing their knee, cartilage playing football, industrial injuries, all the different ways that humans have found to injure themselves. But then there's occasional tumor. Certainly we deal with degenerative arthritis, also known as osteoarthritis, but it's just the wear and tear that our joints sustain with aging. And then osteoporosis, that's a growing problem as the baby boomers get into their senior years. And if they don't take good care of their bones, then they are prone to fragility fractures. And the main one that's very serious is hip fracture, that we typically say that people twist and fall and break their hip. But I think, in fact, what happens is that the end of the thigh bone close to the hip, it becomes osteoporotic and weak, and a person twists and breaks their hip and then falls, but it happens so quickly that they don't associate it that way. But that the sad thing is that when seniors break their hip, it is that 50% of them, even though the hip fracture heals, 50% of them never recover their pre-injury level of independence, which means they might have to go to an assisted living facility. They might have to be on a cane or a walker. They may not be able to ascend and descend steps. And so it's a major issue for half the people that break their hips. And then even worse is that 20% of elderly people who break their wrists, they die within a year. And it's not the hip fracture that is the fatal event, but it's pneumonia or bladder infection or pressure sores and so forth. And so here, an ounce of prevention is worth about a ton of a cure in terms of protecting people from osteoporosis. So that's kind of a spectrum of the conditions that an orthopedic surgeon would take care of.
And of course, I think something that's so important for us to know, and it's really how you open up your book, that the first part of your book is all about, you know, what are these sort of scaffolds within our body? What are bones and how do they work? Because I think a lot of people probably, and for good reason, it's sort of presented this way to us in the media and just in our everyday lives. If you didn't dig deep into your biology training, you can't remember back to like your high school or college training if you were lucky enough to have it. You might not think of bone as being alive, but of course bone is alive and it's a very active tissue. But a lot of people, I think about bones the way they think about, I don't know, their hair. They think of it as this like built thing that's sort of dead inside of them and that just is inside of all the living stuff.
I suspect if we stopped five people on the street and asked them what image comes to your mind when I say bone, I think at least four out of the five would conceptualize a cow skeleton drying out on the desert floor. maybe a little cactus sitting next to it. And that's the white, calcium sun bleached aspect of the bone. But that in its living state, it, as you mentioned, is an incredibly active and reactive material. And even though it's just in some places just a quarter inch below our skin, is it, most people never see living bone, and most of us aspire never to see living bone, particularly our own. And so it's kind of the forgotten tissue, but it's remarkable in that it's this meshwork of collagen protein fibers. You can sort of think of like that as a biscuit of steel wool, and then deposited on this meshwork of collagen fibers is a particular calcium crystal. So the collagen meshwork provides some resiliency and flexibility to the bone, and then the calcium deposition on the surface on the surface of these collagen fibers makes it incredibly rigid and compression resistant. And so put together is that it's a very solid compression resistance substance, but it does have a little bit of give to it so that every time that we fall, we don't break our bone, but that the bone yields some and will spring back into place. So the analogy would be like putting plaster on lath or maybe perfusing that biscuit of steel wool with plaster of Paris. And so it's a composite material, and the two parts of it together make up for a material that's far better than either one of the components when we look at it separately.
Right. It's almost counterintuitive to think that if it were so hard and so rigid, it would actually be more fragile. So to have this sort of minimal but definitely present almost elasticity in the bone is so important.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I think that the other thing that is maybe not surprising when we really think of it, but is definitely not the first thing that comes to mind when people think about bone, is what is dynamically happening inside of bone. You know, I think everybody has heard the word bone marrow. Many of us have eaten bone marrow. We also know about maybe bone marrow transplants in individuals who have leukemia. But to really think about what's happening deep inside of our bones is not something that we crosses our minds very often.
But very important is that, first of all, the structure of bone is novel in that our long bones, our cylindrical bones, are very hard and dense on the outside. But then on the inside, they have this fine, open meshwork. A good analogy here would be a loaf of stale French bread. The surface provides the structural rigidity and the resistance against the bending and twisting forces, but that if this cylinder was solid, it would be incredibly heavy. In fact, by having the cylinder pretty much hollow, except for this meshwork of fine lacework inside, is that it makes it much lighter. And then in early life, this marrow cavity is where most of the blood cells are produced, to the point of about 5 billion a day or something like that. So there's a rapid turnover of blood cells, and that's what we call red marrow. And then as we age, is that more and more of this red marrow is replaced with yellow marrow, which is, in fact is fat. So it's a storage compartment for fat. And so when we have marrow bones in the restaurant, then the buttery inside of the bone is what we like to spread on toast. And that is what that yellow marrow is. So yeah, the hollowness inside makes the bones light. So we can, for instance, birds, they have virtually nothing in the interior of their bones. And so their bones are very light, and so they can fly. But then for the rest of us, it's a storehouse for blood cells in earlier age and storehouse for fat later on.
That's fascinating. I guess I never really thought about the fact that we have fat in our bones.
Yeah, we have it everywhere. At least it doesn't show.
Right.
But we have it everywhere.
That's so funny. You know, I often love to think about the sort of central question, especially when it comes to the history of science and medicine, which is, you know, how do we know what we know? What kinds of experiments were done? What kinds of investigations were made? And when it comes to something as sort of fundamental as our skeleton, the history of when we first really started to grapple with the idea that we have bones inside of us must go way, way back.
Indeed. I mean, I think, you know, even pre-civilization is that if early man was wandering around, they would see the remains of not only their kin, but that certainly of, animals that, were living among them, but didn't think much about them. I think at some point they realized that a long thigh bone made a pretty darn good club and
right.
Served as a weapon. And then somewhere along they realized that they could chip bone and turn it into spear points and fish hooks and so forth. But the study of bone as a science and really anatomy is the oldest of the medical sciences. Astronomy and mathematics would be older sciences, but anatomy was the first medical science. And I would place that back in Alexandria about 250 BC, because at that time, Alexandria was really the center of learning for the Western world. And Euclid was there, for instance, but that there were a lot of very learned people from a lot of different areas of interest. And it's interesting that as people came to visit the scholars in Alexandria, they were stopped at the gates, and their scrolls that had their information on it were taken from them. And then they could spend as long as they wanted in Alexandria to learn what they wanted. And as they were departing from the city, is that they would be given copies of their scrolls, and their scrolls would be kept in the library of Alexandria. I thought that was pretty good way. but unfortunately, at one point, the library at Alexandria burned, and a lot of really amazing material, primary material, was lost with it. But the story I want to tell about anatomy in Alexandria was that I am told that that was the first example of there being on display a human skeleton that was articulated, meaning that it would, looked like you envision in the doctor's office, where it's on it's on a frame, and there's a skull, and then hanging off of it's the chest and the arms and the legs. And we sort of, I can go around my neighborhood and still show you articulated plastic skeletons that are left over from Halloween. But
right.
in 250 BC, people would come around the world, come from around the world to look at that and to study it. And then Galen, in the about 100 AD, he was a Greek doctor working in Roman times. He was the doctor to the gladiators. You could sort of think of him as being their sports medicine doc, but that he got to see a lot of gladiator type of wounds and war injuries. And he wrote a lot about bone, but that he never did human dissections because those were forbidden by the ethics of Rome and Greece. And so he and his compatriots, they dissected monkeys and bears, but then he assumed that the skeletal anatomy of humans was identical to that of these other animals. And so he wrote very authoritatively, with really no firsthand information, about the anatomy of the human skeleton. And that his writings continued to have credence among medical specialists for another 12 or 1300 years. It's just amazing, what the short half-life of medical information is these days. If I write a paper, I'm happy that people are still thinking about it and haven't completely torn it apart in 5 years. Right. For Galen to be the go-to source of medical information for over 1,000 years is just amazing. And at the time, the Roman philosophy was that intuition trumped observation. And so that if somebody was dissecting at 900 or 1,000 AD, and they came across a discrepancy in the anatomy in their dissection that differed from what Galen wrote, well, they wrote off their observation. They said, well, there's something abnormal about this specimen because, look, Galen said it's this way. And so they discounted their own observations. And so then it really wasn't until the Renaissance and named Vesalius, interesting guy, he graduated from medical school in Padua one day, I think this was like 1532 or something like that, and he became professor of anatomy at Padua the next day. So very rapid promotion. we don't see that these days.
No, just, we don't.
Just in our dreams. But that he was the first to, at least in writing, dispute Galen. And he said, you know, Galen's wrong. But I mean, it was considered heresy at the time, you know, to fly in the face of this master who had been, you know, bowed down to for over 1,000 years. But really, that was the beginning of modern observational science, where, you know, people just didn't speculate about how things were, and but that went out and actually, you know, took measurements and, you know, scrutinized things and cut them apart and looked inside and so forth. And so, you know, we're still doing that today.
You know, it must be pretty fascinating to compare what we know now, not just to, you know, what Galen was writing about 1,500 years ago now, or more, but even during the sort of evolution of modern scientific inquiry, how different our perceptions were hundreds of years ago versus our understanding now.
Well, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons I enjoy science, is that there's always something to learn. You can either, you know, discover something absolutely new, like Rentgen discovering X-rays. Nobody had an inkling about what that was going to be like. But also, you can work back over known material with new methodology. I mean, as an example of this was, I write about in the second part of the book about this great paleontological hoax that was foisted in the early 1900s in England. And this fragments of excavated fossils had been dug up, and they came from a little village in southern England called Piltdown. So this was known as the Piltdown man. And the amateur paleontologist who dug it up, he was a bit of a fortune seeker. But that this raised great interest among the paleontologists, not only in England, but all the way across the world. And it really put England on the map, because at the time in the previous decades, the first Neanderthal man had been discovered in Germany, and there were ancient human and pre-human bones being discovered in France and other places. And that here, prior to World War I, there was a lot of national patriotism, national pride going around, and England, you know, couldn't hold themselves up paleontologically compared to the countries on the European continent. And so the Piltdown man was easy for them to buy into for those reasons. And so this was thought to be the missing link in the story of man, and that several people associated with Charles Dawson, who was his amateur paleontologist, several of them got knighted because of their contributions. Dawson died several years after his discovery, and had he lived, he probably would have been knighted as well. And this went along as gospel for about 40 years. and that it was sort of like people disputing Galen. How could you dispute the findings of the Piltdown man? One of the problems that several of the investigators complained about is that Dawson and then his progeny would not let them inspect the original bones. This was a piece of a skull and a piece of a jaw and a tooth. But they could inspect replicas of this, but they couldn't really inspect the original data. And so where I'm going with this story is that in about 1950, a new study came along. It's called fluorine analysis. And there's a certain amount of fluorine that's in the natural water supply. And so if you buried a skeleton and all the bones were from the same animal and they were all buried at the same time, is that when you dug the bones up years or decades or centuries later, all those bones are going to have the same level of fluorine in them. And so in about 1950, curious minds took tiny little pieces off of the Piltdown man's bones and analyzed them. And lo and behold, the fluorine levels were different in them. In other words, they came from different animals. And so science finally did correct itself. In this instance, it took about 40 years, but that science is alive and it changes and moves. And as more studies come along, as we can go back and learn more things. I mean, when people begin excavating fossils from Ice Age and so forth, is that nobody had any idea that that by 2020 or even 2010 that we could begin doing DNA analysis out of these bones. Unfortunately, DNA doesn't seem to be durable enough that we can ever anticipate to extract it from dinosaur fossils, but that certainly for animals that fossilized more recently than the dinosaurs, is that those studies come along. And to me, then the really exciting thing is that undoubtedly there will be new methods of study come along. And so we can look at Lucy's bones again. We can look at the Piltdown bones again. Utsi was this man who was, you know, found frozen in a glacier on the border between Switzerland and Italy about 20 or 30 years ago. And he's being preserved and very carefully studied, and he recently was removed from his ice display case and taken to be studied by MRI, but that he will be a treasure trove for scientists for generations to come as new studies and new ideas about how to analyze his clothing and his body to learn more about culture at that time.
Yeah, you know, it's fascinating because I think when I first sat down to talk to you, I was so focused in my mind on the idea of living bone, of dynamic bone inside of a living organism, that of course I wasn't even thinking about the fact that bone is the persistent structure. If, you know, if the organism is lucky enough, I suppose, to be sort of preserved in specific ways, the thing that is going to persist the longest is going to be that bone. And there's so much to learn about the evolution, about the sort of geographic history, even the social history of animals by studying their bones, whether they're fossilized or just old. There's so much that we could gather.
Well, right. I mean, that's, as I was writing this book and thinking more and more about it, I came up with the phrase that it's the world's best building material. And the more I got into it, the stronger I believe that, because it not only supports vertebrate life from the bony fish all the way up to mammals, but then its structure is also the only really durable tissue that withstands the rages of time after the original owner has passed on. We wouldn't know anything about the dinosaurs if it weren't for this. Think about Lucy, 3.2 million years old, and a important you know, addition to the anthropologist's understanding of development of humans, that none of this would have been possible had not the bones been incredibly durable. And then on a shorter scale is that just the burial customs of various cultures has allowed us to learn much about the cultures. You think about ancient Egypt, or you know, finding bones, human bones from 100,000 years ago in caves in Israel that were obviously placed there with sensitivity and with associated grave goods. And so that as far back as that, people were had a spiritual sense that, you know, to respect their recently deceased and to treat them with care. So then, you know, I suspect that the paleontologists and anthropologists are a little bit nervous for their great-grandchildren who may want to follow them in their specialty because of the growing interest in cremation. Because if a greater percentage of people continue to get cremated, well, then, you know, these bones are lost from future study. But I'm going to have to let somebody else worry about that one.
Right. No, that's true. It's interesting to think how that sort of anthropological record is going to change, and, you know, really has changed over time. There's so many
questions about
that as well. You know, there's plastic in the record now, and that didn't exist.
Well, right. The Inuits, for instance, early on, a bone was their go-to building material. They, you know, surfaced the runners on their sleds with the bone to make them slide better. They took jaw bones and ribs out of whales to make rib structure support for their winter lodging. And then, of course, they used bone for spear points and fish hooks and cooking utensils and toys and ornaments and you name it. And then, you know, metal came along and plastic came along and Amazon came along. And I don't know how much you know, indigenous people these days are using bone as their primary building material. But there certainly are a lot of craftspeople presently. They may be crafting bone with their power Dremel instrument rather than rubbing it against a sharp stone. But that bone is a beautiful material that's being used for jewelry and ornamentation. And fortunately, there's a never-ending supply of bone compared to ivory, which, you know, as the world bans become more strict and more strictly enforced, that fortunately the elephants should be looking around at each other with great smiles on their faces and say, you know, I think we're a little safer now. Because people are crafting in bone, you know, and don't need our big teeth to amuse themselves with.
Right. And you know, there's so much, like you said, there's an abundance of bone that doesn't have to be, because of its persistence and its quality, you know, these organisms don't have to die for the bone. Anytime they're dying for food, for air, warmth, for any other reason, that bone exists. And also there's so many natural deaths. If you go to a place that's relatively wild,
right? But I mean, the a great use of bone occurred during the Napoleonic Wars, where the French who were captured by the British, they were just sort of kept on house arrest in England, and a lot of these French sailors had been fine craftspeople prior to the war, jewelers, watchmakers, those sort of craftspeople. And so how did they while away their time while they were prisoners of war? Well, they got bones from the kitchen, from soup stock. So these would be mostly cattle and sheep bones. And they would craft them into the most incredible objects. Ones that really knocks my sock off were these models of sailing ships, that just, you know, had to take thousands of hours to make it, but they are just really remarkable in their detail and their replication. Some of them even had cannon ports that would open and close and so forth. All of the rigging, they took human hair to make the rope for the riggings. But not only did they make these ship models, but then they also made little toy furniture, and they made working replicas of spinning jennies, and ironically also of guillotines. And oh, wow. And then because they were on house arrest, they could they were allowed to go into the village on Saturday for the, you know, local weekly market and sell their craft projects, and thereby, you know, get enough money to maybe buy some extra tobacco or whatever. And that this was sufficiently lucrative for them at the end of the war. Some of them didn't want to go home. Some of them said, this is a perfectly fine life. I'm staying here and continuing crafting wow. things, crafting things in bone. So, yeah, there is a lot of bone, and people have done a lot of remarkable things with it. One thing that surprised and really pleased me as I got deeper into this was that my wife and I have always enjoyed going to museums of any sort, just because it's a, you know, it's a visual wealth of really the best that humanity has to offer. Mm-hmm. And but we were in Phoenix for a meeting, and I had a free afternoon, and I just took off to go to the Musical Instrument Museum just because it was there. But then was dumbfounded when I got in there to say, well, look at that. A lot of these musical instruments either are made out of bone, or they have bone components to them. And right. you know, of course, flutes from all over the world, from at least as far back as 40,000 years, have been made out of bone. But there was also from Central America, a ukulele where the body of the ukulele was an armadillo shell.
Oh, and, cool.
And learned that a lot of bagpipe fittings are made out of bone. And so, you know, I went to the museum with no expectations whatsoever to learn anything about bone, and it would just knock my socks off. Or another one here, not too far away from me in Los Angeles, is the Channel Islands Maritime Museum. It's in Oxnard, California. And mm-hmm. I had been up the coast to some Indian museums, you know, expecting and to find bone objects, and I did. But on the way back, I said, oh, you got an hour, I'm just going to go in the Maritime Museum. Well, that was where I first saw these prisoner of war whaling ship models. So they had five or six of them in there. The wow. best collection of those is at the Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis. From looking at YouTube videos, it looks like they have 25 or 30 of them. Occasionally, one of those will go on sale on eBay, and they typically run from like $10,000 to $15,000, something wow. like that. So, you know, it's just old scrap bone from the soup pots during the Napoleonic War. And, you know, here we have these beautiful, you know, permanent facts of human culture. So you know, it support bone supports verb life, and then later records Earth's history in terms of paleontology and anthropology, and then also human culture.
Yeah, this idea that there is this record, and the record extends beyond natural history and into art history.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
As a beautiful substrate, you know, an artistic building supply, as it were. But there's also this interesting iconography that comes along with the image of the bone in its natural state. You know, I think about skeletal forms. I think about the catacombs in Paris, which I've been lucky enough to visit, and the intense emotional experience that you have when you're surrounded by a display of natural human remains, but that are organized in sort of like very unnatural ways. It can evoke a lot of emotion.
I understand that. my wife and I visited a bone chapel in Évora, Portugal, a few years ago. It's a about an hour, hour and a half drive east of Lisbon, and I had learned about that on the internet. And in particularly in Eastern Europe, there are a number of bone chapels, but that the guide at Évora said that Portugal was very wealthy in the 15th and 16th century because they had colonized Brazil, and Brazil was full of gold. And so a lot of gold was coming into Portugal. And the priests at the time were feeling that their parishioners were turning away from the church and being fascinated by the glitter of gold. And so what they did was to collect skeletons that were 2 or 3 years old, 2 or 300 years old from, surrounding parishes, and then bring them all to this chapel in Évora, and then very artfully surfacing the walls and the columns and the beams and the ceiling with, rather artistic displays. And certainly the human skull lends itself to that in these complex curves, and then this stark contrast of the black openings for the eyes and the nose, and then the just the rather white curves elsewhere. And so, even if you didn't associate it with the human form, I think somebody look at it and say, well, that is a really interesting object to look at it. And so they did that up grand. And my wife and I were really the only ones in this chapel, and she's not in medicine and puts up with my obsessions about bones. And she looked around for a little bit, and I said, well, I need to take a few more pictures. And she said, I'll wait for you outside. So and when I went to the catacombs in Paris, I offered to take her with me that day, and she said she had some shopping to do.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. And, for me, I love that experience, but it could
somewhere along the line, I think I had lost that sensitivity in the cadaver lab in medical school, or standing around in the Hall of Bones at one of the natural history museums. I don't know if that's good or bad, but it's just the case that I don't get those sensations. Yeah, the Paris catacombs are interesting because they, as you probably know, they were formed, these big underground quarries were where all of the limestone came from that built Paris in the, I guess, 14th, 15th, and 16th century. So curbstones, pavers, bridges, buildings, they all came out of these underground quarries. And then they were kind of forgotten about. But then I believe it was about 1700 is that the churchyards were just overflowing with remains of deceased parishioners, to the point that they were burying people on top of people, and eventually taking bones up and stacking them. But it just became a logistical problem in terms of what to do with all these bones. And so they said, okay, well, let's take them and we'll take them at night, and we'll take them in covered wagons, and we'll put them in the Paris catacombs. And so I don't know. They figure there may be 7 million.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Skeletons that were moved into the catacombs, and then they were pretty well forgotten too. And they certainly weren't open to the public. Time has gone by. I think maybe once a year, royalty or dignitaries could be guided down there to see them. But then in recent years, it's become a tourist attraction. And 2 points on, well, 3 points on that is that when I was waiting in line to go in, there were some younger people in line right there with me, and we had to wait about an hour in line. And so, we were talking about everything and asked them how long they'd been in Paris. And they said, oh, we got in last night. And I said, well, you know, and the catacombs is on the top of your list to, of all the, have you been to Paris before? No. And you're coming to catacombs on your first day? Yes. And so that suggested that that was a fine tourist attraction for them. And then I also discovered that, you know, French are relatively religious, but that the catacombs is open on Christmas Day. And then you may remember that you, it's probably about a mile a walk through these subterranean tunnels where you see the skeleton. Well, they've kind of sorted the bones out. They've stacked skulls in columns or made a wall out of skulls. And then behind it, the wall and the kind of in the crypts, they've just randomly placed the other bones. But so you wander around for about a mile and maybe 45 minutes. And then as you come up the spiral stairway back up to daylight, well, right there, as you resurface, is the catacombs gift shop.
Oh, yeah, you definitely exit through the gift shop there. That's true.
No museum is going to miss that. Miss that opportunity. So it is an attraction, and I suspect for a lot of people like you and my wife that it is. Maybe a little creepy.
I think you misunderstood me.
Reverential.
I think you misunderstood me. I love it. I have a positive emotional experience when I visit someplace like that. I've actually been to the catacombs twice. But you're right. For some people, I think it ekes them out. But for other people, I think there's a profundity of being around that many corpses. What I really think is beautiful about the catacombs is that even though it was sort of just a repository for all of these, you know, overflowing cemeteries, they're this kind of, you know, eccentric artist/city planner that they tasked with putting this project together really saw it as an opportunity for great beauty and artistry. And so the organization, as you mentioned, of the skulls, the stacking of the long bones, the like keystone placements of these things is beautiful and almost does have a reverent, you know, I'm a non-believer, so it doesn't speak to me in that way, but I could see there being almost like a church-like reverence for that experience for a lot of people. I mean, when else are you going to be around millions and millions of fellow men and women?
Right. They all had personalities and, you know, had problems and things they laughed at. And one of the problems, no, I wouldn't say problem, but that these bones are of no use to a scientist because they're all mixed up. You might
mixed up, yeah. They were just dropped in the hole.
That's right. You might see a skull and see that they had great wear on their teeth, but then, you know, where's their thigh bone? We can't look at their knee to see whether they had osteoarthritis there or, you know, whether they had syphilis or, you know, amputations or really no benefit to medical science by studying those bones. And so, you know,
and a lot of them weren't really cared for either. You'll see a lot of post-mortem injury, like just holes in the bones and chips in the bones, because they literally just like would take barrels of them and drop them down a hole and then, arrange them.
When you have seven million, at some point you lose your sensitivity toward them. Right?
But it is interesting to me to think about this. The iconography of the bone, especially I think of the human bone, but also of paleontological specimens and more modern specimens, and how they really do in many ways, I think, represent a very human experience of mortality that other biological icons don't necessarily do. You know, looking at a liver, for example, it's a textbook picture or a liver in a jar, it doesn't evoke the same emotion that looking at a skull does.
Well, right, because it doesn't take much imagination to, you know, put some skin and lips and eyeballs, hair on a skull and imagine, what the living person had been like.
Yeah. And so it speaks to people, I think, in a special way. And you're right, for certain, you know, portion of the population, I think it evokes that very existential, very common fear of death and really does eke them out. It sort of makes them want to turn away from it and not really contemplate that aspect of their own existence.
Well, this interesting stories about that is that best I can tell is that from about the time of Pompeii, you know, very early AD, there was a mosaic that had a skull, and it also had a surveyor's level on it, and these were under the table. And the interpretation is that you know, death is the great leveler of life, and so at least for 2,000 years, the skull has, you know, been a representative of death. And then through the Middle Ages, is that skulls were incorporated into architectural embellishments on buildings, and certainly they began to appear on gravestones. And so that by the Middle Ages, this is where we had the skull and crossbones as a symbol of death. And this was co-opted by the pirates as a sign of danger. And that, you know, this has come on into modern times as, you know, on poison bottles. And, you know, some of the motorcycle gangs use the skull and crossbones as their motif. And then by the 19th century, to go back just for a second, is that then the artists began to paint skulls. And I think they not only were interested in representing this idea of death, and they talked about memento mori, or, you know, remember death. And so there was a school of Dutch painters, particularly in the 16th century, that would paint these portraits. Either they were still life, or they might have a person in them, but that the still life would include a hourglass that was running out, you know, bubbles that were popping, candles that were flickering and burned down, rotting fruit, you name it, any image that, you know, suggested decay or decline, they would put it into these paintings. And of course, then there was the dance of death, and Saint-Saëns did that and represented the rattling bones with the xylophone. Yeah. And, you know, this was the time of the plagues, and the people were dying left and right for no recognizable reason and so forth. And so that I don't know that the artists really had to remind people about the transience of life, because there were certainly a lot of reminders on a daily basis. But then to get into the 19th century is, I think artists just started painting skulls not to scare people or to, you know, warn them or anything, but just because it was an interesting object. Cezanne painted them. Picasso, you know, and comes up on into modern art of artists representing skulls.
Yeah, I mean, you see it now. It's a totally common tattoo iconography.
Well, it's right, and also it just got into all of our consumer goods too. Mm-hmm. I mean, on the conveyor belt at the airport one night, waiting for my bag, and here comes a plastic bag around, but it has skulls molded into the side of the case,
and
you see it in jewelry and watch faces and high-end, you know, art objects and clothing. And I think it's lost its symbolism in terms of, you know, remembering death. It's just kind of an interesting...
Perhaps it's normalizing that a little bit more.
That's
you know,
right.
that the kind of regular exposure to this, you know, long-standing symbol of death is maybe helping people with their psychological hang-ups around.
No, I don't. We have plenty of other problems. We can eliminate that one. But I mean, you know, there's even a brand of beer that on the six-pack cardboard carton for the bottles is a it's called Voodoo Ranger, but it has a skull on that. Yeah. He's wearing some little fur cap or something, but that I don't think people buying beer thinking too much too much about their own mortality.
I don't know.
Maybe they should be, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's so interesting to see this sort of, I don't know, to juxtapose in our minds the sort of living and productive, dynamic function of the bone within the body against the timeless story that the bones that have been left behind can tell. Mm-hmm. And it's really cool to me that it's the same object.
Right.
You know, like that it's the bone that you work with in your practice and the bone that you kick up from the forest floor when you're on a hike. I mean, that's hopefully from an animal, not from human remains, but for all intents and purposes, this is the same physical substance. Mm-hmm. And it represents such very different things for us culturally.
Absolutely. And then talk about representing culturally. The story that I really like is Henry Moore, the 20th century British sculptor. He was bombed out of his flat in London during World War II, and he moved out into the country on what had previously been a pig farm. And as artists typically do, is that they, you know, collect interesting objects and take them back into their studio to use them as inspirations for their art. So that he said, as he walked around his property, he would pick up the occasional pig bone that was scattered around. He also liked rocks that had holes in them, and that he would take them back. And if you look at his sculptures, particularly his reclining woman series of abstract art, and then if you looked at a vertebra out of a horse or a pig or a human, and you know, rolled it over and looked at the way the various planes merge into each other and how the openings swirl around and so forth, is that once you study that, you look at one of Moore's reclining woman sculptures and say, I know where he got that idea. I see that exactly. He's just reflecting the nature of the vertebrate skeleton in that. And, you know, so those are bronze. They're timeless. They're priceless. And it tickles me to no end to know that where this idea came from, and that whether the casual viewer knows it or not, they're getting a bony anatomy lesson when they when they look at his sculptures.
I love that. Well, so I mean, this book that you wrote, Bones Inside and Out, it obviously covers so many different aspects of just the concept, the structure, the existence of bones. And of course, we don't have enough time to dive deep into all of them. But is there anything that that we didn't get to in our conversation that you feel like, ooh, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about it?
Oh, yeah, about six more hours worth.
But that's what the book is for, right?
But to just to pique a listener's interest is that being an orthopedic surgeon, I discuss the history of orthopedic surgery and discuss six of the pioneers who really made monumental differences in the way that modern orthopedics has come about, and then talk a little bit about modern orthopedics and the amazing things that 3D printing is bringing along, the issues of osteoporosis during space flight. That's going to be a big issue in terms of not having people get fragility fractures on the way to Mars and back, and the way people are thinking about that. One way they're studying that is that bears hibernate for 5 or 6 months. They're totally inactive. And by all intents and purposes, they should get osteoporosis, but they don't. And so there are intrepid scientists who are sneaking into bear caves in the wintertime, sedating them, and then drawing their blood and sneaking back out and seeing what's different about bear metabolism and hormonal control than ours, and that there may be answers here that will help people preserve their bones during a prolonged spaceflight. And then I have a chapter on imaging and talk about the history of discovery of X-rays. Actually, Rentgen discovered X-rays 125 years ago this month, but then, you know, moving on up into computerized tomography and magnetic resonance imaging and what those different images can do. And there may be other imaging techniques that come along in the future that will even be able to tell us more about bone in its living state. So it has a very interesting and colorful past, and I think a very exciting future. And so I'm pleased to be the, I guess, sort of the announcer of this, and that I continue to learn more and more about it myself, and am continuously fascinated by it.
Absolutely. And you know what, Roy? I always close my shows by asking my guests the same two questions. And so given your career path and given your interests and, you know, the wealth of information that you've included in your book, I'm interested to see how you respond to these questions. They're pretty big picture. Are you ready for that?
Sure.
All right. So I want you to think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now. It could be, you know, having to do with your work, your personal life. It could be having to do with politics or global issues, even something more cosmic in perspective. And the first thing I want to know is, what is the thing that's keeping you up the most at night? What are you the most concerned about, worried about, maybe even pessimistic about? And then on the flip side of that, what are you genuinely, really, you know, optimistically looking forward to?
Well, those are great questions. I am an optimist. The bottle for me is always half full. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for the best in myself and the best in other people. I try not to watch the daily news with too much seriousness. I do watch it, but part of it's just for entertainment nature and to learn more about human nature rather than to be upset about it. I have great faith and prolonged lifelong interest in science, and that I currently have a proposal circulating to write a children's version of Bones. And this would be a middle grade reader, more highly illustrated. I mean, even though the current book has 150 illustrations in it, the children's version would be more highly illustrated. But that my interest in doing that, and I guess that's what I'm looking forward to in terms of thinking about and maybe waking up at night and thinking about, is stimulating young people's interest in science, technology, engineering, and math subjects, even if they're not going to become one of these as they're on their career path, is that I think that society in general is going to be much better off the more people have a good understanding of these topics and how it fits in to our you know, management of the world, you know, politically, ecologically, you know, every single aspect.
Hear, hear. I think you are saying that to not just the right person, but the right audience here on this show. And I bet you a lot of people are sitting in their cars or on their workout equipment or doing the dishes, and they're nodding along vigorously with you as you say that.
Well, stand up. While you're nodding, stand up and, you know, do a few jumping jacks or hopping in place to keep your bones and your spine and your hip nice and sound.
Ah, great, great advice. Well, Dr. Meals, this has been such a pleasure. Everybody, the book is Bones, Inside and Out. It is available everywhere you can buy books. Thank you so much for joining me today. I learned an awful lot.
Thank you, Kara. It was a great conversation. I enjoyed talking to you.
And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.